we are about halfway, we're over halfway through our tour through Mark's account of Jesus and the gospel. And for much of the first half of Mark's gospel, he sought to provide us a profile of the person of Jesus, who he is, why he's come, and why anybody should listen to him. But when Peter makes his confession in chapter 8, saying that Jesus is the Christ, the plot shifts into a different gear, if you will. Mark is going to continue to unpack who Jesus is, but from that time forward, he's going to start teasing out the implications for us of who Jesus is. And by implications, I mean ethics. The ethics of following Jesus, the practical applications of embracing his identity. That's what ethics are. Ethics are what guide our decisions, they guide our choices, they guide our actions, and they're expressed in principles. But they're more than principles. Ethics are more than just behaviors. Ethics express our deepest convictions. Show me what you do most, and you will show me what you believe most. Your ethics reveal and sometimes betray your heart. So we're going to look at two passages this morning that actually have a common theme in that they both address the ethic that's at the heart of following Jesus. They are two passages that really actually form a triptych, a threesome of text in which Jesus first speaks of his destiny of suffering, death, and resurrection, and then it will explain how his destiny means to be followed by those who follow him. Three times Jesus is going to teach the theology of the cross, and then he's going to teach the ethics that follow from it, because theology and ethics are inseparably linked. And the funny thing is, Jesus is eminently clear about this central ethic of being a disciple, and yet the disciples could not be more shockingly dim-witted about the ethic that is Jesus' teaching. Perhaps the only thing more shocking in their misunderstanding would be to let out a burp at a funeral. It's that shocking, that sort of misunderstanding, that sort of incongruence between what he teaches and what they seem to get. Our passage this morning is going to look at that ethic in three ways. It's going to talk about what that ethic is. It's going to explain why that ethic ought to be followed. And thirdly, if this ethic is meant to be the deepest expression of our heart and not just a behavior, then the question it answers is, how do we begin to practice the ethic with integrity? What is this ethic? Why this ethic? And how do we begin to practice this ethic with integrity? So, we're going to look at two texts that are separated by a chapter. Would you stand for reading first from chapter 9, verse 33, and then we'll skip over to chapter 10, starting in verse 35. Chapter 9, starting in verse 33. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." And then chapter 10, starting in verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." And Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to him, The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. As I said in the introduction, chapters 8, 9, and 10, Jesus is going to speak about his destiny, how he's going to suffer rejection and eventual death and be raised again. And our passage today represents the second and third texts in those three episodes. And in each of those passages, no sooner is Jesus done talking about his destiny that at least one disciple says something that reveals just how clueless they are. In chapter 9, just before our text, Jesus has gotten through saying how he will, quote, be delivered into the hands of men, they'll kill him, and when he's killed, after 3 days, he will rise. That's in the disciples' ears. That's in their minds as they're chatting along the way to Capernaum, which was on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee, up in the north side of Palestine. And when they get there to their little rest stop in Capernaum, Jesus puts them on the spot and says, what were you all talking about on the way there? And they don't say a word. It's silence. Why has the cat got their tongue, so to speak? Because they know they've been caught, engaged in something that doesn't befit who they are. Jesus has just spoken about his death that awaits him, and they're jabbering about which of them is the greatest among them. Which of them is worthy of the greatest esteem? If there were some sort of well-done, faithful servant award that came with a gold watch and the 2 weeks in the Mediterranean, who, they ask, would be there at the photo op with Jesus? Jesus is talking about his death, and they're talking about themselves. Really? That's what you're doing? It's like being at the bedside of a terminal patient and then asking them, hey, did these jeans make me look fat? It's that sort of shocking kind of consideration at that moment that's what the disciples are engaged in here. And just when you think it can't get any worse, in chapter 10, the disciples are walking again with Jesus. This time they're on the way to Jerusalem. And Jesus has again just said, he'll be delivered out of the chief priests who will condemn him to death, deliver him to the Gentiles. They'll mock him, spit on him, flog him, kill him, and after 3 days he'll rise. And again, that little foreboding speech is in the disciples' ears. And still, James and John walk up to Jesus and say, we want you to do for us whatever we want. And Jesus says, what do you want? And they say, grant us to sit at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. Now, to their credit, they are acknowledging their belief that Jesus is the king who's come to usher in a kingdom. And that kingdom will have a splendor and a glory to it. But they're asking for cabinet positions in the glory. They're actually trying to get dibs on positions of prestige and authority. As they say, they're looking to cash in before the body's even cold. Why does Mark choose to include these ridiculously embarrassing portrayals of the disciples? Two reasons, I think. One, that you and I might see ourselves in them. That we might see our instinctual self-absorption. Back in the 70s, Richard Dawkins, whom you've heard, wrote a book a few years ago called The God Delusion, who's perhaps the most outspoken and strident atheist out there. He wrote a book in the 70s called The Selfish Gene, which argues that our genetic quality is inherently ordered towards maximizing its advantage, towards maximizing its survival. He wasn't arguing that it's because of our genes that you and I are selfish, but he's arguing that our genes are such that they do everything they can to proliferate and live and survive. The disciples here are in this moment providing some fairly good evidence that our instinct is to maximize our advantage. I want the position. I want to be at your left hand and at your right hand, Jesus. And even before the disciples, the disciples were even walking the earth, the philosopher Plato, he imagined a ring in an imaginary tale he wrote called The Ring of Gyges. And this ring would enable a person to become invisible when they wore it. Sorry, Amber, Tolkien didn't come up with that. All right. The Ring of Gyges would allow anyone to become invisible if they wore it. And the question that Plato's characters posit to one another is, what would human nature naturally and instinctually do if they knew they could get away with it and never be known? And it's their argument that men would naturally maximize their advantage, take advantage of their not having to be accountable for it. And therefore, it was their sense that human nature ought to always be suspicious of human nature. Mark is looking to confront in us what is so instinctual to us by including what the disciples have in common with us. What is that? A deep-seated, unrelenting self-interest. But the other reason that Mark includes that moment is really to set up the ethic that Jesus is trying to beat into their heads. He's trying to beat into our heads. The disciples provide a foil for what it means to follow him. And here we're going to begin to hear the ethic that Jesus is teaching, which is in one sense not what you think. In both of these awkward instances where the disciples show their interest in greatness and glory, you don't hear Jesus say, "Don't seek greatness and glory." There is no language on his lips that say, "Shame on you for wanting to be great," or "How dare you want to exult in glory." The interest in greatness and glory is not Jesus's criticism. Greatness and glory are qualities of distinction, of excellence, of resplendence. They designate the one who possesses it as worthy of honor and esteem. And the thing is, everything that's alive on this planet seeks to naturally be great. To grow, to become mature, to become larger and more robust than what it was in its infancy. Now, yes, everything here dies, but all things naturally seek the fullness of their own nature. They seek to be great. And so the first part of Jesus' ethic here, you might be surprised to discover, is for us to seek greatness and glory. He doesn't belittle that instinct. We're to have an interest in what is worthy of respect, not simply to become passive and disinterested in all things. That's not the ethic he's teaching. But where Jesus does confront them, where he redirects their passion for greatness and glory, has simply to do with the way they think greatness and glory will be found. In this world, with the genes we find ourselves with, it is our instinct to find our greatness and glory with ourself as our topmost priority. We rise to the top by ingratiating ourselves with those who are at the top because we have ourselves at the top of our concern. But in chapter 9, Jesus says, if anyone's going to be first, he's got to be last and servant of all. He's saying, find your greatness not by prioritizing yourself, but by forgetting yourself. And by forgetting yourself, Jesus means putting others before yourself. Now, both of those ways of phrasing this ethic sound nice, and you and I are nodding our heads in agreement. I already see it, right? But look, those are still so abstract, so out there, that we can in as much really kind of wriggle our way free of what they're really asking. And I think Jesus gets that because he does this little object lesson with a kid. He's sitting there in the home with his disciples. Apparently children are present, and he brings a child to him and puts him in his lap And he holds him in his arms and he hugs him. Now to us, that's not weird. That's endearing. And if anybody knows anything about Jesus, we would expect him to do that because we know Jesus is tender. We share in that tenderness for children. We buy them stuff. We embroider stuff. We emboss stuff. We do all the stuff. We take their picture from the moment they, you know, come out of mommy's womb until they hit 21, right? That's what we do. We get that kind of tenderness. The disciples would have looked at you like you had a horse's head. To the disciples, it's plain bizarre, the point that Jesus is making and using a child as his object lesson. That era would find the way that you and I elevate children somewhere between laughable and outrageous. Children were nearly at the bottom of the social scale. There would be no Olin Mills in the first century. He would have to find other work. Jesus is saying, however, you don't know the way to greatness. You don't know what it really means to follow me until you're willing to serve those who are the least regarded. And children were nearly the least regarded. Sorry, kids. It was a different world. Consider yourself fortunate. He's saying you have to put them before yourself and see to their goodness and greatness. Now, what Jesus asks sounds radical, and in some sense it is, but it's not as foreign as you think. You can't be a friend, you can't be a spouse, you can't be a parent unless you adopt the ethic that he's teaching here. Friends, spouses, parents, colleagues, they have to forget themselves if they're to fulfill that role. They have to see to others' greatness if they're to be great friends, spouses, and parents, period. And you can't even be a good owner or a manager or a project leader in a business unless you adopt the same ethic. If your only bottom line is the bottom line, then is it any wonder that any employee who works for you just feels like a cog in your machine? But if you think of them as something meant to grow and become great as much as your margin hopefully becomes great, then you might make less, for sure. But you will have shown them a dignity that honors them as the individuals they are. That's what it means to adopt that ethic. And so his ethic of self-forgetfulness here means you have to ask in all of those relationships, for whose sake am I most concerned, mine or theirs? And if I can press it a little further and make you feel a little uncomfortable, even amid your sacrifices for others, you still have to ask, for whom am I really doing this? Them or me? I have humbled myself before you in telling you the story that one time, after I had spent a very long day of trying to clean up our house and did it in a rather huffy and petulant mode, that my wife said to me, without even thinking about it, "Sometimes I wish you'd be more thankful than helpful." What'd she mean? My helpfulness was really not helpfulness. It was about getting my way. Even in the midst of my sacrifices, I have to ask myself, am I thinking about them or her, or am I thinking about me? We have to inspect all our relationships for that ethic. We as a church need to begin praying and asking God, who is near us, who has been forgotten the most, or who has been regarded the least? And then the follow-up question has to be, how might we serve them well? The picture of the sculpture on the front of your bulletin is from last year, and I hope that you caught it before you had to look at the title of it. Yes, it looks like a homeless person, but look at the feet. The picture of the sculpture on the front of our bulletin is meant to confront our instinct to write off those whose society has written off already. Yours and my, perhaps, our first instinct is to assume that anyone who's homeless is there because it's entirely their fault. It might be true. And while it is not our place to serve the least in a way that will perpetuate the pathologies in their life, neither should we withhold help on the front end simply because of their pathology. The ethic that Jesus is teaching is in part to let your greatness be found in seeking the greatness of others, even those whom all the world finds anything but great. That's his teaching in chapter 9. And he's only going to ramp it up in chapter 10. He's saying to find your glory by forgetting yourself. But in chapter 10, he's saying you need to find your glory by being willing to suffer. Suffer for Jesus and the gospel. James and John ask for positions of glory. Jesus doesn't chastise them for the kernel of their aspiration to rule with him in glory, but he does challenge their conception of the path to glory. When he asks them, are you willing to drink the cup that he drinks? He's invoking an Old Testament image of God's wrath. If you were to look in Psalms or do a word search in Isaiah or Jeremiah for the word cup, they all speak of God's judgment in the metaphor of a cup. All who bear the judgment of God are said to drink from the cup of his wrath to the dregs. And when Jesus asks if they're willing to be baptized with his baptism, he's asking them, can you handle the cost of being identified with one who will be hated? Can you go there? When we baptize somebody here with water, it signifies cleansing from God, but it also signifies identification with him whose blood did the cleansing. James and John are seeking glory, but Jesus is asking if they're willing to find their glory by being associated with one whom men will find shameful. If you can, it means you know that your strength and your identity is in him. If you can't, it means that you are finding your identity somewhere else. What Jesus is asking here in chapter 10 is nothing new. Ever since chapter 8, he's been saying, you got to deny yourself, you got to take up your cross and follow me. And what that means is, sometimes the only thanks you're going to get for your sacrifices is to be spit upon for them. It means that sometimes you will be vulnerable for another's sake, and for the sake of the gospel, and it might end with them betraying you. Faithfulness to him can, does, and will mean that you lose something or someone as a result of that faithfulness. And I don't need to tell you that, because you know it. You know it will cost you to follow him. In many places, that's going to put your life in jeopardy. Around here, it's more likely to put your reputation, your status, and in some cases, even your career in jeopardy. That's the ethic. Why, though? Why the cost? Why do we got to go through this? Why lean against my instincts that come so naturally that I have such a hard time putting aside? He's going to give us three reasons why. One, this ethic honors God. He's holding the child in his arms in chapter 9, and he says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. The word receive there is the word for welcome, to accept someone, to embrace them, to honor them. And Jesus makes this radical pronouncement that to honor the least is the same as honoring him. The one who has preached the kingdom and who identifies himself as its high king is saying, you don't really honor him as king unless you're willing to honor those who are low. And what's more, to honor Jesus is really to honor the Father who sent him. Do you understand how counterintuitive and countercultural that is? When presidents and premiers come to a city, the first thing the city fathers and mothers do is to clear out the vagrants. Jesus is saying, you don't really honor his presence unless you invite the vagrants to dinner. Why the inversion of values here? Why does it take serving the least in order to honor the greatest? Because it's the nature of God to be a servant to the least. In Genesis 2, God looks at Adam and says, it's not good for him to be alone. And so he fashions for Adam a helpmeet, a helper suitable for him. And the word there for helper is the word ezer. the wife becomes an ezer for her husband. But on no fewer than a dozen instances in the Old Testament, God refers to himself as an ezer. He calls himself the helpmeet, including in our call to worship today and in the hymn of preparation that we just sang. O Lord, come thou fount of every blessing. Here I raise mine Ebenezer. Hither by thy help I'm come. I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. It's the word Ezer. Therefore, if anybody should start to bristle at the idea that making those kinds of sacrifices for the least is beneath you, remember, it wasn't beneath God, and you're beneath him. Snap. The ethic honors God. But the ethic, secondly, is also what furthers the plan of God. Will James and John drink the cup and be baptized with the baptism Jesus asked? They say, we will. And what happens when he dies? They scatter. In one sense, they can't drink his cup or be baptized because only he can go to his cross. But in another sense, they're going to have to drink his cup and be baptized. They're going to have to enter into the suffering of the Lord. Why? Because faithfulness to him is bound to provoke resistance, rejection, and persecution. There's no way around it. You don't walk around in that era. You don't walk around in any era claiming that in Christ alone is healing hope in heaven without drawing somebody's blowback. You can't demonstrate this ethic he's talking about for long before it begins to challenge and undermine conventional wisdom, and that provokes blowback. There is a place for argument and logic and reason to make a defense for our belief. Both the Apostle Peter and the Apostle Paul say as much, but there is perhaps no more potent way to show the worth of the one who loved us than to be willing to suffer for him. If you choose to take blows for the sake of the gospel, that speaks volumes of your sense of his worth. If you choose not to retaliate when assaulted for the gospel, whether it's physically or verbally, it shows a kind of strength in you that is its own testimony to your belief in the sufficiency of God. That's how it furthers the kingdom. The ethic is not asking you to suffer for suffering's sake. It's not asking you to go find a way to suffer. It's not asking you to prove your faith by suffering. It's saying this ethic is providing a context in which people might see his worth. And there is no greater context to see that worth than when you're willing to suffer for his sake. That's the second reason why. The ethic honors God. It furthers the plan of God. And then thirdly, this ethic protects you from a danger. The dangers that come with the conventional way of pursuing glory and greatness. James and John, after they have their little question and answer with Jesus, they fall back in line with the disciples after their forthright request, and the rest of the disciples give them the stink eye. Not so much because they're offended for Jesus, but because they got beat to the punch. Jesus says that what is off-kilter, Jesus sees rather, that what's off-kilter in James and John is true of all the disciples, and so he sits them down in the house, and they all have a literal come-to-Jesus moment. He references them to think of everybody at that moment who's in power in the Roman Empire. And he says that those who see power like they did as an ultimate good tend to do all they can to remind everyone that they have power. They protect it, they preserve it, they try to expand it, and above all, they seek to prove their power because that's their glory. And history has a long and sordid list of people who fell into that default position, and we have adjectives for people like that. We call them dictatorial and tyrannical and totalitarian. But that impulse to find our glory apart from serving others can work more subtly and in ways that every one of us can identify with. Václav Havel died 2 years ago. He was the playwright, who ended up becoming the president of the Czech Republic in what was called the Velvet Revolution. He was the most unlikely leader. He wrote an essay while he was in office that spoke of political power and why people pursue it. And he says, on the front end, many people seek political power because they want to enact things that lead to human flourishing. And that's a good thing, to be welcomed and upheld. But he says that there's a parallel impulse at work. One can see power. One can seek power in an attempt to gain self-affirmation. In other words, to like oneself, to be satisfied with oneself, to feel okay. Now, there's no wrong in taking some satisfaction in achievement or in authority. But preserving power for the sake of propping up one's self-importance, he said, can become so important that you use the power for your own ends rather than enriching the ends of those who entrusted you with the power. Power is only one of many things that you and I can try to find our glory in, apart from the glory that comes from serving God. And if we think our glory is in something else, in our job, in our kids, in our reputation, in where we live, in what we drive, then we will drive ourselves into the ground to make sure it's intact and usually take many down with us in the process. Jesus gives us this ethic of forgetting ourselves because we need it, lest we forget everyone else in the course of trying to find our glory apart from Him. This ethic is not meant to constrain you. It's meant to liberate you from a drivenness that seeks to find your glories in things that will never be preserved. We've talked about what the ethic is. We've talked about why this ethic is in place. Finally, we got to ask, how now? Where do we go from here? We said at the beginning that what Jesus asks is not some behavior that you just adopt like an exercise or a diet. Unless the ethic comes from a deep conviction, you and I will only nod at the approval of the idea of it, but remain essentially unmoved by it. How then will this ethic, its nature and its rationale, be born in us? Two things. You have to look to Jesus as a model, and you have to look to Jesus for a particular motive. To say that Jesus is our model, He doesn't ask anything of us that He doesn't do Himself. He is not the proverbial overweight supervisor that sits under His umbrella eating a jelly donut while He watches the swarthy guys dig the ditch. That's not Him. The Son of Man, He says, came not to be served, but to serve. And so He did. He left what was comfortable and entered into squalor and rejection. He demonstrated infinite patience with all He encountered. And He died, not as an accident of history, but as the plan of history. He came, He served, He's our model. And if He's a model, then He will only be a model for us to the extent that we understand Him. Unless you and I are prepared to really ponder Him, really to meditate upon Him, really to imagine Him, then He is no more our model than the runner that wants to become a great model, a great runner, but never looks at the tapes of any other great runner. They don't want it that bad if they don't want to look at how other people did it well. He has to be studied as a model if He's going to be a model. Because for models, when they're really seen as models, they inspire emulation. Don't turn there now, but go home this afternoon after the picnic and just pick up 2 Samuel 23. King David is under siege by the Philistines. He's encamped in something called the stronghold. Something equivalent like the green zone. Right? That safe place. And around him are what's called his mighty men, what we might liken to a Delta Force. David expresses his longing for a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, from where he has come. And his mighty men take the challenge. They punch through Philistine lines. They grab a skin of water and they present it to their king. And David looks at that skin of water and he looks at these men who are, must be sweating and catching their breath, having just come through that dangerous territory. And he sees that sacrifice. And rather than drink that water, he opens the skin and pours the water upon the ground as a sacrifice of praise unto their sacrifice for him. He is so moved by their example that he cannot help but wish to emulate their sacrifice. They gave what was precious to them. He did likewise. Brothers and sisters, you and I have to study and ponder the service of Jesus until it moves us to do likewise. He's the model. But here you have to be very careful. Jesus can never strictly or exclusively be your model. When your mom or your dad or your teacher said, "Why can't you be more like brother, sister, classmate, president, whatever?" Their intent in asking that rhetorical question was to get you to change. But the motive for that change was some sort of cocktail of guilt, shame, and regret that you weren't like all the rest. And so the carrot that was laid before you wasn't the love of the virtue itself that they were trying to get you to practice. It was the promise of acceptance if only you'd find the strength and the courage to be like your brother. Jesus said, "Follow me and be like me." But his words were not couched in the terms or the tone of, "Why can't you be more like Jesus?" How do I know that? Because there's one word in this text that Jesus uses to describe himself that explains, in fact, on our own, we can't be more like Jesus. You know what that word is? It's the word ransom. The word is not so old that it's inaccessible to you. It's a payment, specifically to liberate someone from a debt or a tyranny. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus' death that awaits him was a payment of sorts. And it was that death that liberates those for whom he died from sin, from guilt, from death, from the devil. And his death as a payment liberates is what brings us into the acceptance of God. That's the gospel. Which means two things. You and I couldn't ransom ourselves. We couldn't orchestrate our own acceptance. And secondly, therefore, the motive for our service to him and the least of these is meant to be out of love for him ransoming us. Ransoming us from an eternal separation and into an eternal acceptance with God. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, the love of Christ controls us because we've concluded this, that one has died for all and therefore all have died, and he died for all that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. To know that Jesus is the one who died that we might live to be a ransom for us is no longer to live for ourselves, but the motive for living for him is love. It's to be controlled by his love. Living for him is meant to proceed from loving him for what he did to bring us to God. The beauty of Christ's love inspires sacrifice for Christ, who himself is beautiful. Jihei Park is a Korean violinist. You should go watch the TED Talk this afternoon. I watched it yesterday for the first time. She sought to be the most celebrated violinist in the world. And under the crushing weight of that pursuit, she fell into a deep depression. And ironically, she says, it was the music itself that lifted her out of that depression. The beauty of the instrument and its capacity to captivate when well played became her abiding aspiration. The desire simply to honor the beauty of the music itself replaced the obsession to be celebrated by the whole world. And now she plays with no less brilliance, but now with a different motive. That's what the gospel does when you get it. You don't try to impress anymore. You don't try to prove anything anymore. You don't try to merit his love anymore. You simply desire to honor the beauty of him whose love can't be compared or earned. You don't serve until you're ransomed. You serve because you've been ransomed. You don't serve until he accepts you. You serve because it's the only logical response to having been accepted already. That's the gospel. The more you know you've not been forgotten, the easier it is to forget yourself. The cross says in a way that nothing else can, you are not forgotten. And the more you believe what the cross says to you, the less inclined you are to cling to yourself or to what tells you that you're not forgotten. And therefore, the capacity to take last place, to be a servant, to drink his cup, to be baptized as he was baptized, rests and is refreshed by a sense that his becoming nothing is what enabled you to become something to the only one whose approval really matters. That's why we're coming to this table. This is the bread. This is the cup. This is the cup that points to the cup of God's wrath that he would drink. But it is also the cup with which we identify ourselves with him, and which also anticipates how we will encounter the kind of rejection that he faced as an expression of living for his sake. It points to the ransom he paid for you, but it also implies the role that you now possess as one commissioned to show forth his worth by being willing to suffer for him. You couldn't have set this table, but you can walk in its way. And therefore we come to it again to ponder the ethic that took Jesus to his cross and to wonder how we might walk in appreciation of it. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.